Well, it is wonderful to get to be on Baylor's campus. I've been here a couple of other times across the year, but they're so far apart that I will not live long enough to come again. And it's just great to be here. I look out and see some of my students, Ralph West and Mark Both. We're on a trip we took to England to study English writers. And we were all reading Jane Austen, being kind of pansy, but I like Jane Austen books. You know, everybody gets married at the end of a Jane Austen book. If they can stand up, they get married. And I like those kind of stories. And we just had a great time. And Hewlett, thank you for that. You know, the sweetest words in the English language are Jesus saves. And the second one is, I read your book. And the third one's, let me get the check, by the way. So I want you to take your Bibles, if you will, and turn with me over to Psalm 22. This is kind of a preacher's psalm. I like this because I know some of you have come here. You're not going to say anything about it, but your heart is broken. You've been a Baptist preacher, and it's really hard to be a Baptist preacher, and certainly love Baptists is hard. I want you just to turn to Psalm 22. I love this psalm. I want to start reading, first of all, at verse 12, an odd verse. Many bulls surround me. Strong bulls of Bashan encircle me. Roaring lions tearing their prey open their mouth wide against me. Just another deacon's meeting. And he says, I am poured out like water, and my bones are all out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. It has melted away within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs surround me. A band of evil men encircle me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. And 175 Baptist pastors are fired every month. Sounds a lot like Psalm 22. But I want you to turn just to the first words of it a moment, if you will. Because these are the words our Savior spoke that first Good Friday. I don't know whether he spoke them or whether he sang them. I'm sure he heard this sung in his little synagogue in Nazareth. People say that it's improper to suggest that a man in great pain could sing. But all the martyrs did it. I suspect Jesus might have. And here's what he sang if he did. My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from the words of my groaning? I want you to notice in these 11 verses just a little progression, if you will. In the first part of verse 1, it sounds like God is no longer present in the world. He has forsaken his loved one. Why have you forsaken me? The second part of verse 1, he says, maybe you didn't abandon me, but you're sure a long ways off, God. Step 2, why are you so far from saving me, from the words of my groaning? I love that passage over in Romans 8 where Paul is talking about the Spirit making intercession with us with groanings that cannot be uttered. Take heart. When your heart is broken and you don't know how to say it, the Spirit doesn't seem to know how either, but it's great to hear him groaning with your agony in the background. I cry out to you, but you don't answer. By night, I'm not silent. You're enthroned as the Holy One. You are the praise of Israel. In you, our fathers put their trust. They trusted in you, and you delivered them. They cried you and were saved. They trusted in you and were not disappointed. Then there's step 3, when we're surrounded by critics, within the church association, the denomination, things that seem at times to be the will of God. But listen to this. I'm a worm, not a man, scorned by men, despised by the people. They mock me. They hurl insults. They circle me, shaking their heads. Let the Lord rescue him. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him since he delights in him. And then there's this step 4. When the heartache is all over and we've cried all we can possibly cry, there is home. We come back to the all-sufficiency of Christ. Yet you brought me out of the womb. You made me trust in you, even at my mother's breast. From birth, I was cast upon you. From my mother's womb, you have been my God. Don't be far from me, for trouble is near. And so at last, we're home again after this cycle of despair. Well, I want you to think about this with me just a minute. I think this psalm really came alive to me one day. We had a little house in New Mexico, and there's a great tree that stands in the front yard. I sometimes go out and sit down at that tree and watch the world happen around me. Hummingbirds come up to that feeder of mine, turn at right angles, and slurp the sweet out of my little red feeder. And I love that place. Then one summer, we had this nest of rock squirrels, a mother and a dad, and lots of little rock squirrels, about four or five of them. We loved to go out and have a cup of tea and watch them play in the sun, and they seemed to know we were watching, and they seemed to like it, and they did this. It was a wonderful, wonderful thing they did. But one day, our Methodist neighbor, who has a Methodist cat, came over the wall and grabbed one of those little guys and took him off. And the rest of the family scuttled back into the rocks. And then for the next hour, really the next 24 hours, the high piercing scream of a mother who can't put it all together. And I remembered where I'd heard that before. It was when my own brother was drowned in a farm pond, and I was 4 years old. My sister said I don't remember it quite well, but I remember it. I remember them lifting me up over the edge of that little casket and hearing my mother, that silent, silent scream, trying to put it all back together. And if we said to her, oh, Mom, don't feel bad. You still have 9 kids. She had way too many kids, especially the last two. And I thought about it. They said, you can't do this, Mrs. Miller. You still have 8 kids left. Ah, but she said, I want them all. There's a heartache that can't somehow be put back together, because somehow we are in this world and we have to go through all the pain that exists out there. And the step begins. The step that says, my God, I can't get to you. I think everybody reacted a little bit to Mother Teresa's confession in Time magazine. But you know what? I understand that perfectly. I've read all her books. I love her. I happened to be in Calcutta when she died. But I love her books. They're just simple little old things. You know, I don't think she's even among the great saints who wrote, but there's something marvelous about her. And if all after her death, she comes back to the realization that there are times even with Jesus when we can't put it all back together, is she not more normal than we would like to admit? Is a struggle not ours as well? It's hard. You know, I think of my great crises. I remember one day in August, like in 1971, I was standing at the drinking fountain between the services in our little church in Omaha. It wasn't a very large church, and it really wasn't very large that August. And I was getting a drink, and the chairman of deacons came up to me, and he said, have you seen the crowd upstairs? There's a euphemism. There was no crowd upstairs. And he said, you know, I really believe God is leading you to resign the church and leave. Golly. I said, you know, John, thank you. So sensitive just before my service here. And he said, well, Pastor, you know, you're the kind that can start churches, but you can't grow them. You need to resign and leave. Well, you know, we had no church to speak of. Later, we would have a choir, a geritol bass, a clarol soprano, but at this particular stage of our life, there wasn't anybody behind me looking out except me. And for the next 6 months, he'd stand on the road, big guy he was, fold his arms, and just look hate into me while I tried to sing Just As I Am. Folks, it was hard. Oh, it was hard. And finally, I just didn't think I was going to be able to handle it anymore. And I decided I was just going to resign. At first, I thought, what will I do? But after the pain becomes severe enough, you think, I've just got to get out of here. And I wrote out my resignation. Then I did something I would invite you to do when your my God comes. I wrote out that resignation. But just before I went out preaching, I called a friend of mine who happened to be home that Sunday morning. He said, well, why would you resign? I said, because I don't like this church. He said, but you've always said it was a great church. I said, yeah, but I lied. It's not a great church. And I said, I want out of this thing. He said, well, maybe it's okay. Maybe you should resign. But he said, instead of just resigning, why don't you just go out there and tell them how you feel about them? I thought, you know, I can't do that. He said, why? I said, because I don't use profanity in the pulpit. And he said, well, go out there and just tell him. If you're going to resign anyway, tell him. You know, I got to thinking about it. And I don't know whether the Lord took hold of me or the devil, but I really got excited about that idea. I walked out that Sunday morning, and I didn't read him my sermon. I didn't read him a text. I didn't tell him what the Bible said. I wasn't sure I even believed the Bible anymore. And I stood up and I said, you know something, folks? The way you've treated my wife and I the last 6 months is ungodly. I said, you ought to cry out to God for your sin, for the way you've treated the pastor and his family the last 6 months, especially the big guy. You know what? It was a great rebuke, but let me give you some advice. If you're going to rebuke your congregation, don't cry. I started crying. I'm not really good at rebuking. And I started crying, and I don't even like the way I cry. I like the way Mel Gibson cries. I like that single Australian tear highlighted with silver cinematography. That's what I like. When I cry, my face wrinkles into a prune, and healthy people begin to throw up as they did all over the auditorium. Then an interesting thing happened. They began to come forward to the little altar in our tiny little church, and they began to pray and ask God to forgive them. I tell you what, folks, I didn't preach that, so it didn't much matter whether I did or not. I just didn't. The truth is, I had come to the last place I could possibly go. My God, why have you forsaken me? And somehow, as God often does, he began to speak to the whole congregation at once, and the speech was rich. And old John, my adversary, he left. I stayed 22 more years, and the church grew to 3,000 people. You just never know. All I know is that somehow in those moments, step one hangs over our head, my God, why? Then you go to step two. Why are you so far from me, O God? I love the Apostle Paul, but I like him best in 2 Corinthians, the 12th chapter and the 7th verse. I don't like him necessarily when he's telling me how to feel about God. I mean, that's important. What I really like is when he says in deep confession, to keep me from becoming conceited, there was given me a surpassing great revelation, a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan, set to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord, take it away from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest upon me. I tell you something, folks. There's nothing greater than being little in the presence of a great God. When suddenly you come down to that place where you honestly say, there's nothing about me that's very strong. I'm a whimperer. I cry easy. That's why, for Christ's sake, he says, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. This scolops. You know what's bad about these sufferings of ours? We put on such a good show. People walk in the back doors of our church and their hearts are breaking. 50% of them are working in some kind of problem as they come in. That's okay, because 50% of the time as a pastor, I stand up, I'm working through some kinds of personal pain. But don't we play a bold game? We sing, we shake hands. There's nothing apparently wrong with us that a great moment of confession and humanity might not heal if we could manage it, the honesty of that. Well, you know, I believe somehow Thoreau was right. You know, there's a grief that can't be spoken, says the character in Les Mis. And Thoreau said, we all live lives of quiet desperation. A little more recently in our life, a terrible thing came over our family. We had to kind of pray through it and work through it. But I can remember I was just new at Beeson, and somehow I wanted to be strong, and yet this thing was so oppressive that sometimes on the way to school I'd pull off under an interstate bridge and I'd just cry to the Lord and sit there and cry. I'm a crybaby, folks. I'd cry and I'd cry and I'd cry till I could get my face pasted back on. Then I'd go into Beeson and talk about the rich love of Christ like I knew what it was all about. And I tell you something, folks, God in those days convicted me of this little statement by Thoreau. There's a quiet desperation about us. We carry it in, we carry it out, we don't confess. I'm convinced that us guys have the worst kind of problem with it. I've always liked the way that women in the church will kind of pair off and find another woman, and they'll tell each other their whole heart, but not us guys. We're going to be tough. We're going to be strong. We're going to bear this. We're not going to tell anybody about this. So we die 5 years before our wives do. They marry somebody else they really have fun with. Paul, the psalmist says, why are you so far from saving me? And then he comes down to step three. The God who seemed remote is pushed back to the edges, and he's circled by critics. I am a worm. I am not a man. And I'm despised by all the people who mock me. They hurl insults at me. They shake their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him. There's nothing greater, by the way, than what I did that morning when I called my friend. A network, just a little network. We don't have to carry this stuff by ourselves, if we'll be honest. We can find someone who will join in this with us if we're honest about the problems we have. Because I believe that when we do that, there's something so beautiful that begins to happen. There's nothing like a network between two needy brothers. I was driving down the interstate with my grandchildren, my grandsons in Fort Worth, Tarrant County. Went by the big billboard there on the interstate that said, come and see Ariana, the human arrow. There was a picture of this woman on the billboard in a silver suit, and then it said, Ringling Brothers Circus, now, Tarrant County Arena. My grandson saw the sign and said, Grandpa, can we go to the circus? I said, sure, I'm just teaching at the seminary today. Let's go to the circus. And so we did. I never will forget it because they have, and I have somewhat of an interest in this woman who's Ariano, the human arrow. When all three rings dwindle down to one, and Ariana comes out from the sideline, she waltzes around the center ring. The spotlights are on her. The drums are rolling. Everybody is going crazy for just a little bit. And then there's a huge sense of quiet. A little green tractor comes out from the side, pulling this huge catapult that looks like a bow. And they bring it out to the center ring. They sort of tap it down in the ground and lock it in place. Then the little tractor goes around behind the bow and pulls that steel cable out on that bow till it looks like it's going to break. And they hook it over a windlass. Then he puts off the field, and we're there. It's the quietest I've ever heard 10,000 people be. And then Ariana goes and stands on that cable. And there's a drum roll while we all compute her IQ. And then they trip the windlass, and she flies off in the darkness. What's interesting, in just a little bit, the spotlight comes on, and they play a huge net on the far side of Tarrant County Arena. And there she is, Ariana, standing up. She's still alive. She can do this same stupid thing the next night in Peoria because somehow she had a net. I think there's a horrible isolationism in the ministry. Man, we pay for it all by ourselves. We're circled by these critics, the psalmist says. And then he says last, yet I brought you brought me out of the womb. You made me trust in you, even at your mother's breast. From birth I was cast upon you. From my mother's womb you have been my God. Do not be far from me, for trouble is near. You know what? When we fought it all the way through and we've been mad at God and we don't talk to God and we've hurt and we've hurt and we've hurt, finally we come back to this place where we have to say, from my mother's womb, you've been the only place I can go. I haven't always come back to God because I worked it through and read a great book. I go back to God because I just can't find anywhere else in this world to go. And there's where I end up. I have run the gauntlet from an absentee God to a great homecoming. You know, I was at InterVarsity 1977. Helen Roosevelt had just come back from the Congo. Now, I'll never forget this. This is a great sermon she preached that night. 17,000 college students were there. She had this tree stuck down in a little bucket of sand with green construction paper leaves all over it. And she began to tell about the ordeal of the Mau Mau uprising. When she said, I prayed to God that somehow God would spare my life and the lives of all the missionaries I knew and all the little people who came to my clinic. She'd been a doctor since she'd gone to Keswick and found Christ. She came back to England every 4 or 5 years looking for a husband that somehow would go with her and share the work, and never managed to find anyone to share life with her. She lived alone. But she said, the very night that I was praying for God's protection, the doors to my clinic were knocked down. And these huge soldiers came in. One of them hit her across the face, lost her glasses. She could see a thing without them. She lived the rest of her incarceration without those glasses. Then they took her out and gang raped her, threw her back in a bamboo cage. She said, this went on and on. And she said, I finally hated God. And then she said, one night, when I was all through with my pity party because all I was undergoing, she said, they threw a little nun back into my box who had been going through the same thing I was. And she said, she kind of snuggled back against me. And she said, instinctively, I reached out and put my arms around her and pulled her up to me. She gave me a great principle, by the way, that night. When you can't find God, play God for somebody else, to somebody else. She hugged that little nun and prayed for her. Then she said, almost audibly, I heard God say, Helen, didn't you say I could have your life for any use I would make of it? She said, yes, Lord. And do you now withhold that gift you gave me, said God. I watched that night because as she told the story, she kept pulling the leaves off that tree. And as she reached the end of her testimony, she was down to just a stick in the sand with no leaves at all. And at that point, life could possibly begin again. I owe my life to the great poets I think that the Christian faith has produced. One of those, unquestionably, is Amy Carmichael. Wanted to be a missionary to India, found like just almost every missionary I've ever read about. Then when she got to India to really be a missionary, she was miserable. She couldn't speak the language. She didn't know another soul. She was all by herself. This misery just kind of built in her. She couldn't figure out why in the world she had ever gone to India. Then she said, one night, I was coming home at the market, and I passed a slave block, and they were selling a little girl to be a sex slave to some men who were bidding on her. She said, I was so repulsed by the whole thing. She said, I just took out my purse of money I had and I began to bid on this little girl. And she bought the little girl. She actually won the bid. Then she said on the way home, she further rebuked herself because she said, not only did I not know why I was in India, I didn't know I had a family now. And we're all in India. And I have no idea why I'm there. But across the next few years, she bought 900 more little girls. And she knew why she was in India. And she asked that question that's so prominent from the cross. My God, why? A little perspective, you can get an answer to that thing. And she asked the question, hast thou no scars? No hidden scars on foot or side or hand. I hear thee sung as mighty in the land. I hear them hail thy bright ascendant star. Hast thou no scars? Hast thou no wounds? Yet I was wounded by the archer spent, leaned me against a tree to die, and circled there by wolves which compassed me, I swooned. Hast thou no wounds? Hast thou no wound, no scar? As the master shall the servant be. Pierced are the feet that follow me. Yet thine are whole. Canst thou have followed far who have no wound, no scar?